This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A day after a lower court in Zimbabwe upheld a month-long ban on anti-government street protests, opposition and civil society groups are appealing the decision to the country's highest judicial body, the Supreme Court.
That's Sebastian Monfu reporting from Harare. Details coming up.
Also, former UN Refugee Agency Chief Antonio Guterres will be the next UN Secretary General. The Italian Coast Guard says nearly 11,000 people were rescued on the Mediterranean in the past 2 days, and an American citizen has died near the capital of Ethiopia, where there have been anti-government protests.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, former Portuguese Prime Minister and former head of the UN Refugee Agency, Antonio Guterres, is the Security Council's unanimous choice to be the next UN Secretary General. The Council made its decision after considering 10 candidates in all. It will hold a formal vote tomorrow morning to recommend Guterres to the 193-member General Assembly.
A day after a lower court in Zimbabwe upheld a month-long ban on anti-government street protests, opposition and civil society groups are appealing the decision to the country's highest judicial body, the Supreme Court. Sebastian Monfu has more from Harare.
Politician Tendai Biti with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights Wednesday filed the appeal. The move came after the High Court of Zimbabwe dismissed an application that called into question the legality of the ban imposed by police.
Quite clearly, the judgment of the High Court is wrong, so we're entitled to appeal. For constitutionalism, the right to protest, as defined in our new constitution, are so compelling, such that I wouldn't think that any court would refuse the insurmountability of those arguments.
Last month, the High Court ruled that an earlier ban on the protests in Harare was, quote, invalid, unquote, because it was not done procedurally. That decision led to the second ban, which was upheld Tuesday. Before the bans, Zimbabwe had been rocked by an unprecedented wave of protests calling for President Robert Mugabe's government to fix the moribund economy and respect human rights. Police then resorted to force and arrest to quell the protest. Activist Linda Msarira was released last week after spending 82 days in jail for protesting. Msarira said she thinks it is time to change strategy to challenge the 92-year-old president's leadership.
The demonstrations have failed. People are being beaten up. People are being abused. Why should we continue with a strategy which is making people go into situations which we do not want? We are fighting against those injustices. The Constitution allows us to demonstrate, but they are unleashing the reign of terror using police officers and state security agents against activists so that they instill fear in us, so that they silence us. But we will not be silenced. We are tired of this regime. We want change. We want to restore Zimbabwe back as the breadbasket of Africa.
Hunger and poverty are two of the issues that have brought Zimbabweans into the streets since July. The country has about a quarter of its 13 million population depending on international aid for survival. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Every week, thousands of migrants attempt to sail across the Mediterranean from North Africa to Italy. They're jammed aboard unseaworthy vessels provided by smugglers, hoping to be rescued before they capsize. Many are rescued, but many are not. One of the vessels patrolling near the Libyan coast is the Dignity One, which is operated by the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke with the ship's field coordinator as it brought more than 400 migrants to safety.
When I spoke with MSF's Nicholas Papachrysostomou, the Dignity One was sailing near the southeast coast of Sicily. It was Tuesday, October 4th, the day after a tough and sad day at sea. Such days are becoming too common for the crew.
We search every morning for stray vessels, stray boats, stray flimsy dinghies that would be cramped with people. Sometimes we are lucky and we bump into them or we catch them with our own radar, which means that we are close to them. But as you know, the region, the area is huge. It's like looking for needles in a haystack.
Sometimes distress calls from migrant-filled vessels are relayed to the ship from the Maritime Rescue Center in Rome.
So they call us and they direct us. Sometimes a boat can be 2 or 3 hours away, which is, of course, equivalent to saying that these people would be 9, 10 hours on the boat sometimes without enough provisions or water.
Often they've been baked by a scorching sun while cramped on a flimsy rubber dinghy 6 to 8 meters long. There may be up to 140 people on board, sitting or standing on a very thin wooden deck. When the Dignity One arrives at such a scene, it sends over a speedboat. Crew members tell the migrants they are there to help them, not arrest them. But many are tired and agitated and not easily calmed and reassured. And sometimes they panic.
Imagine that there are women that are pregnant, there are people with physical conditions, children that may be less than a week old sometimes. It's incredible what we see. It's incredible the courage of these people.
It was a similar scene for MSF's Dignity One and a European warship on October 3rd. But Papachrysostomou says besides suffering from a lack of food and water and being burned by the sun, the West African migrants were burned by fuel as well.
A leakage of fuel spread all over the dinghy, which means that a lot of the people were sitting in puddles of fuel mixed with seawater for hours. These caused an abundance of burns, fuel burns of second degree, of first degree even. We're talking about situations that are very painful.
When the migrants saw the warship approaching, they rushed to the side of the dinghy, pleading for help. That caused it to break.
The boat cracked and a lot of people found themselves in the water. We ended up rescuing people in collaboration with a warship that were in a state of near drowning. This means that if you don't have enough time to resuscitate, you're losing them.
But a shortage of time was not the only obstacle to resuscitating the near-drowned migrants. Many had inhaled petrol fumes for hours, and their breathing was labored, interrupted by spasms. The MSF official says not everyone was saved.
Yesterday we lost a life because it was not enough time. A young woman, a young pregnant woman, eventually passed away on the boat.
He says what's happening in the Mediterranean is a fight between life and death. However, he says European policies are geared more toward deterring the arrival of migrants than welcoming them.
And what have we achieved? In 2016, the numbers have not gone down. The deaths have gone up, now standing at 3,500 people that we know they drowned. I'm not even talking about the people that have drowned and we do not record. And we'll continue like that.
He says the EU is attempting to strike a deal with Libya, so its Coast Guard intercepts more migrant vessels. But he says the migrants are then brought back to a lawless country. Many rescued migrants show signs of being tortured. They are often abused by criminals or smugglers. Since the MSF vessel began operations in the Mediterranean in June of last year, it's helped rescue about 14,000 people. After bringing the more than 400 rescued migrants to a port in southern Italy, the Dignity One set sail again for the Libyan coast. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In related news, the Italian Coast Guard reports nearly 11,000 people, including children traveling alone, were rescued on the Mediterranean in the past 2 days. However, 50 people were found dead. More than 4,600 migrants were saved yesterday, and more than 6,000 were rescued Monday off the North African coast.
While much of the media is focusing on deadly migrant crossings from Libya to Italy, a smaller but steady flow continues to reach Greece from neighboring Turkey. On Monday, the Turkish Coast Guard rescued 34 migrants from a sinking boat off the Aegean coast. Over the weekend, Turkish officials in Izmir province stopped 126 migrants attempting to reach Greece. Reporter Nick Barnett is based in Athens. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle about those trying to reach Greece and those who are already there but hope to resettle in other European countries.
Well, the latest update on the refugee situation in Greece is that there is a flow that continues to come in from Turkey every day. Today, it had actually gone up to nearly 300, despite the EU-Turkey deal that was intended to stop the flow. The islands in the eastern Aegean, where the refugees and migrants tend to arrive on, that are really close to the coast of Turkey, have been dealing for a while now with overcrowding issues, as they are well over capacity. And so a lot of the migrants and the refugees that arrive on those islands have been stuck there for, in some cases, up to 6 months because they're not allowed to leave and they're waiting to be processed. And so they're living in very overcrowded and very shabby conditions.
Nick, how does the situation compare between the illegal migrants on the Greek islands and those who are on the mainland? Are the mainland migrants being resettled?
The migrants and the refugees that are stuck on the mainland are those who had arrived before the borders to the north of Greece, before the Macedonian border and the rest of the Balkan borders to the north had closed, which had this happened towards the end of last winter. They're those that arrived since then, but after the EU-Turkey deal went into effect in March. So they're kind of the about 50,000 or so that arrived during that time period that essentially became stuck on the mainland. Because ever since then, any migrants that have arrived since late March have stayed on the eastern Aegean islands because this is part of the stipulation that's meant to discourage more from coming over from Turkey.
Has the infrastructure for processing refugees improved in Greece?
Well, it still continues to be under incredible pressure, most notably the asylum service in Greece, which is incredibly overburdened. It has essentially been tasked now with processing asylum applications in the span of 2 weeks, but there's people that have been waiting for more than 4 months for their asylum applications to be processed. So this has really exacerbated a lot of the bottlenecking issues that you see on the islands and even to a certain extent on the mainland migrant and refugee centers. So despite the fact that there's been more personnel added to the asylum service and there's been some funds that the EU has sent to Greece to help with the situation, the asylum service and other issues pertaining to infrastructure, such as the locations themselves where they have the migrants at, still continue to run into a lot of struggles because Greece is dealing with very limited resources to accommodate so many thousands of people.
Have many of these refugees that are in Greece or migrants, have they actually been accepted to remain in Greece?
Well, there have been several accepted asylum applications, of course, many of them being those that are from Syria or from certain parts of Iraq and Afghanistan, those who are deemed to be refugees and not simply economic migrants. And they have had a bit of an easier time with not only Greece, but also the EU, because that makes them eligible for a relocation scheme that the EU has been running in order to help resettle people out of Greece and Italy as well, for those that arrived there first, to help resettle them in the rest of the EU. But so far, the resettlement process itself has also fallen well behind the targets that had been set out at this time last year when the relocation scheme started.
How has Greece's economy, which has been struggling for the past several years under austerity measures, how has it been affected by the refugees? Or if we flip that and ask as well, how has the struggling economy affected the refugees themselves?
Well, Greece's economy, yes, it does continue to be under considerable pressure because of more austerity measures that it continues to be compelled to enact in order to satisfy creditors. But the refugee crisis by itself has not affected Greece's economy nationally as much because of the fact that there has been help not only from the EU, but an incredible amount of help that's come in from humanitarian organizations to help issues such as feeding refugees, or providing clothing and other and medical help. There's been a lot of activity from large and small NGOs, volunteer groups, et cetera, that have poured in. So it hasn't affected Greece's economy nationally quite as much. However, municipal governments have had to deal with this in a bit more of an acute way because of the fact that a lot of migrant centers have been set up in local areas throughout the Greek mainland. And so they're very concerned that they're being asked to deal with very limited resources with this problem without adequate help from Athens.
That was reporter Nick Barnett in Athens, Greece. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
The U.S. Embassy in Ethiopia says an American citizen has died after being hit with a rock in an area near the capital where there have been anti-government protests. In a statement, the embassy said a passenger van was hit by rocks thrown by unknown individuals on the outskirts of Addis Ababa yesterday. It added that one of the passengers, a U.S. citizen, was struck and subsequently died from her injury. No other details were provided. Ethiopia has experienced months of sometimes violent anti-government protests. On Sunday, at least 52 people were killed in a stampede after police fired tear gas and warning shots to disperse protesters at a religious festival.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Former Portuguese Prime Minister and former head of the UN Refugee Agency, António Guterres, is the Security Council's unanimous choice to be the next UN Secretary General. And opposition and civil society groups in Zimbabwe are appealing a court decision upholding a ban on anti-government street protests. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Fighting terrorism is a top U.S. foreign policy objective. The State Department runs its own Bureau of Countering Terrorism and Violent Extremism. It works closely with foreign governments to prevent, anticipate, and contain this threat. Justin Sibarel is the Bureau's acting coordinator. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at last week's UN General Assembly session. In part two of his interview, he spoke about states of counterterrorism in Africa today.
Africa is a very, very important region of the world where governments are confronting terrorism challenges, but also demonstrating a level of cooperation and coordination that actually gives us some hope. The big challenges, you have Boko Haram, of course, in the west, in the Lake Chad Basin area. You have Shabab in the east, in Somalia, and in East Africa, Horn of Africa. And you have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is in the north. And then, of course, the Daesh presence in Libya. We may be talking about sub-Saharan Africa here, but the challenges that emanate from Libya, of course, are infecting the security of a much broader region, including the Sahel states. What we see in some of these conflicts, however, is a commitment of the governments to cooperate.
What's the current status of the fight against Boko Haram?
The challenge of Boko Haram is a very serious and real one, and there are many factors to addressing the challenge in northern Nigeria. But since the advent of the multinational joint task force, you've seen a real effect upon Boko Haram. They've lost territory. They are pinched up against the border regions effectively. And it was the rise of the cooperation that began to demonstrate progress. The willingness of governments at the senior-most level to coordinate their actions in the security realm in particular have had a measurable difference.
What about East Africa and Shabab?
Shabab has a challenge and is working to prevent the establishment and the emergence of a Somali government. It is the regional partners who have come together through the AMISOM deployment. Djibouti, Kenya, Uganda, Burundi, Ethiopia, the countries of the region have come together to assist. And so while there are huge challenges there, you have a level of cooperation and coordination which is absent in other conflicts around the world, where you have a disagreement among the neighboring states. You can't find consensus around how to stop the challenge. And so therefore the conflict spreads and it continues and perpetuates.
Here we are toward the very end of the convening of the UN General Assembly. How do things look from your perch?
In particular, this week we convened the ministerial meeting of the Global Counterterrorism Forum. This is an organization of 29 countries in the EU that seeks to establish strong norms and best practices to address long-term terrorism challenges, and in particular to strengthen the rule of law and to develop better tools for governments to prevent and disrupt the radicalization process as it develops.
You mentioned the phrase rule of law before. What did you mean?
The rule of law approach to counterterrorism is the idea that an effective counterterrorism approach begins with a legal code that provides the state authority to address security challenges, but also provides for people to have rights and to have those rights protected. That then extends to laws that lead to, if a terrorism crime is conducted or suspected, to charges. And then that leads to a court process and an open process. And it means a civilian-led approach to dealing with terrorism. What it seeks to prevent is an approach to terrorism that is extrajudicial, that does not have a basis in law, and that relies purely on security measures that do not have the legitimacy of the population. So those countries that have laws, that have ability to investigate and then prosecute on the basis of laws, and then process individuals through a judicial system all the way to incarceration, and that do so in a transparent manner that offered the ability of individuals to defend themselves in that process, is the most effective, in our view, approach to a long-term, credible counterterrorism policy that maintains the credibility and the support of the people.
That was Justin Sibarel, acting coordinator for the Bureau of Counterterrorism and Countering Violent Extremism at the U.S. Department of State. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Belgian prosecutors said two police officers were stabbed today by a man in Brussels in a case being treated as a possible terrorist attack. Police said the officers, who were wearing plain clothes, did not suffer any life-threatening injuries. The federal prosecutor's spokesman said there is reason to believe that it is terror-related. However, he did not provide further details. The assailant was stopped by a second squad of police shooting the man in the leg. Belgium has been on a high alert since 32 people were killed in suicide bombing attacks on the Brussels airport and subway on March 22nd.
Hurricane Matthew left a trail of death and destruction as it crossed over Haiti and Cuba and made its way towards the Bahamas today. The U.S. National Hurricane Center calls Matthew extremely dangerous. It predicts it will remain a powerful storm at least through tomorrow. The storm weakened slightly after making landfall in Haiti with sustained winds of 125 miles per hour, but it is expected to regain momentum as it barrels toward Florida's southeastern coast. At least 9 people have been killed in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It's the worst storm in the Caribbean in nearly a decade. Matthew is expected to make landfall along the U.S. East Coast later this week.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has called for an armed struggle against the government of President Salva Kiir, a move that could mark a renewal of the country's civil war. We'll discuss the new developments in South Sudan next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.